Well, we could probably listen to that entire children's song and learn about the life cycle of the spider, but I'd rather talk about it with our next guest today, because he knows a whole lot about the world of spiders. Rafael Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, back with us. He is an associate professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And as we talk with him, we're going to cover the gamut here. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you can talk about spider behavior that you have observed, maybe in or around your home. Maybe you've seen a very colorful spider in your backyard, maybe recently. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Rafa, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Happy to be here. Thank you for hosting me.
I'm sure we're all familiar with spiders as we've seen them in our homes, outside our offices, other places. But what, maybe a general description of what spiders are and what they look like varies an awful lot.
Yeah, there's a common pattern and then a lot of variation built upon that pattern. So the basic body plan of a spider is two segments, as opposed to insects that have three segments. So an insect would be head, thorax, abdomen. In spiders, the head and the thorax are fused in a single abdomen, and that's called the cephalothorax or the carapace. And then there's an abdomen, and those two segments are connected by a thin pterosaur. And then they have eight legs that they use to walk that come out of the cephalothorax. And then they have an extra pair of modified legs that are part of the mouth parts that they use. Those are called the pedipalps. That's the basic construction of a spider.
Yeah.
And then you have very super long legs, or some that are much chubbier. Some build webs. A lot of them build webs. Some just walk around and hunt.
And the size, a flea jumping spider, that's about the size, of a grain of rice?
They get even smaller than that. You can get them as large as the bird hunting tarantulas that are like plate sized, or the huntsman spiders in Australia. They're even bigger than that. And then you get some miniature spiders that you can barely see. They'd be even smaller than a grain of rice.
Wow. And here in Wisconsin, I think probably our biggest is the fishing spider.
Yeah, those get pretty big. That's about as big as I've seen around here.
Yeah, I think they get maybe 3 inches long or something like that. It gets plenty long. You may be noticing more spiders as you listen here on the show around your home and outside, and maybe that's because it's their mating season. Raf, how does a spider choose its mate? Maybe does it depend on the size of the web or the best web or something?
The reason you might be seeing more around nowadays is, they're on the web, they're normally on their web, they're minding their own business. But when males search out to find mates, then they start walking around looking for females. And that's the extra walking around that people might be noticing around at this season. The males will be looking for chemical traces of females to follow, to try and find the females. All spiders, as they walk around, they sort of continuously lay down a safety thread, safety silk thread. And that has identifying pheromones, identifying chemical features. So males can tell this is a female, trace her, try and find her. Then once a male has found a female, they're in the business of courting her, trying to be accepted by her. And in spiders, that is a very delicate topic, because the vast majority of spiders are predatory, so they're pretty good predators. And the vast majority of spiders, the females are larger than the male. So a male approaching a female is not only asking to be accepted in courtship, is also hoping not to get eaten. And rejection can often be the not get lost, but get eaten. So it's a very delicate approach. Court assess her attitude towards him. And then the features that they assess in courtship, those vary hugely between different groups of spiders. Some like jumping spiders are visual. So they have very, very beautiful dances. They move their legs around, they move their abdomens. Some that are more less visual, more web-oriented, they use vibrations along the web to they send signals along the web to court females. So that's a whole universe of exploration to do with how courtship happens in spiders.
Well, I was thinking back to my earlier days. I guess I've been rejected by females from time to time, but I never thought any other would want to kill me. So that's a kind of a dangerous situation for a male spider to be in. So I.
And there's the common myth that they often end up eaten, or that the males are sort of just not they have no hope. That's true for a few species where if a male finds a female and is very unlikely to find another female, then they not only don't try to escape, they sort of offer themselves as a food item for the female. But in most of the cases, most of the species is trying to live to tell another tale. To live to find another female.
Well,
And
we
sometimes
And some, yeah, and sometimes it works. Jack in Eagle River has a question. Let's go there. Jack, hi.
Hi, thank you. Just curious because I've had a discussion with other friends about this. Are there brown recluse spiders in Wisconsin?
Are there brown recluse spiders in Wisconsin, Rafa?
very few. I used to live in Missouri before coming here, and in Missouri it'd be a daily occurrence. The basement was crawling in them. Here, there, I think you do get them, but very much rarer.
And
Although as there's increasing their range might be shifting north a bit.
they sometimes they might get carried in on other plants or something that that you purchase from somewhere further south. I know my daughter's in Kansas, and they have plenty of brown recluse there for sure. But I read a piece that by scientists who happen to be living in an area with brown recluse, and they had them in the house all the time, and he said they never were bitten.
No, they'll try and get out of your way. If they bite, it would hurt. But I lived in a log cabin in a not a log cabin in a log house, and I saw several per day. And that's if you're seeing several per day, there's a lot more. Never got bitten. Never had any problem. You'd have to like step on one barefoot or go grab one. Then they're not going to come after you.
Jack,
Actually,
there.
no. I know a professor that used to work on do research on brown recluses, and she had her colony in her basement, just reared them there for her research.
Jack, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Steve in Evansville, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. My question is about wolf spiders. We live out in the country and we have wolf spiders a lot. And I learned that they are nocturnal. And if you go out in the woods and you shine your flashlight, you'll see their little eyes shining back at you. And we've done that, and it's amazing how many there are. And I guess my question is, how do they hunt? What do they hunt? Just I find them fascinating.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Rafa?
They're just looking around for, small arthropod prey. They'll hunt on the ground. They'll hunt on plant surfaces. And the eye shine that you see, that's a cool story. They have a reflective surface behind their eye that reflects light back, so they get better vision at night. It's called the tapetum. So that's what allows the eye shine to be particularly noticeable. And it is a freaky. If you go out at night with a light, it's just all of a sudden the floor is covered in light shine looking back at you. They also saw their, you know, they have good night vision because of that. But a lot of spiders also sense vibrations from the substrate. So whatever you're standing, you know, they have almost, you could almost call it an arsenal of sensory structures that sense deflections of their legs, deflections of their body that pick up vibrations from the substrate. So a lot of the hunting they do is orientated by the pattern of movement of the prey, even if they're not seeing them.
Hmm. Steve, great. Thank you very much for calling. Elsa in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Elsa.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about what I've heard are called cellar spiders. They look like a long-legged, almost like a daddy long legs, and I'm not even sure they're classified as spiders. I was curious what their life cycle is.
Those are, I actually have my PhD student is working with cellar spiders right now. Yeah, there's two kinds of arachnids that get the name daddy long legs. There's the cellar spiders, and you can see those have the one segment is the cephalothorax, 8 very long, very elegant legs, and then an abdomen. And the abdomen is also kind of almost rectangular. It's very, also very elegant. And then the other organism that gets called that is they're a different order of arachnids. They're called opilionids or harvestmen is another common name. And those also tend to have, especially around here, most of the species we get are very long-legged. Also at legs, but only one body segment. So it's like one big command capsule and then long legs coming out. The cellar spiders are interesting because they're a species that is, you know, there's a big family of in that group there. It's the family Falcidae. And you get some in the woods, you get some in natural areas. But there's a species that we call cellar spider that are associated with humans. So their main habitat is our houses, our basements, and they have their entire cycle there. The females will lay eggs on the web. The baby spiderlings hatch. Second stage, they start building their own webs independently, and they live the entire life in your house. So nowadays, the hunting males, you'll see like particularly large cellar spiders walking around, not on a web. Those are the males looking for females.
And I've read somewhere, it might have been the DNR magazine had a little piece, and they said, you know, it's not a bad thing if you've got cellar spiders. They might be. It's a good thing, isn't it? Explain.
Yeah. Well, they have the webs they build. They catch other arthropod prey in the house, so they catch the centipedes that you often see around here, or other insects. So they're actually doing reducing the insects and other arthropods from the household. Yeah, like we don't normally allow many spiders, many webs in the house, but we leave the cellar spiders undisturbed. Except when my PhD students come collect my basement is a collecting site for.
Okay. Elsa, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. There is a DNR magazine publication out. I always like the DNR magazine. And the fall 2025 edition has a story. It's titled Autumn is for Arachnids. And a nice piece on spiders. And, it's a good magazine anyway, so the DNR magazine. So it's worth a look. Our guest, Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of are you an associate or a full professor?
Full professor.
Full professor. Okay. Professor of Biological Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. Great to have him with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. If you missed part of our show, or maybe you just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcast. Right now, we're talking spiders with Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. It's great to have him back with us. And you can join in, email or at WPR.org, I should say, or give a call at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Mary in Madison has a question. Mary, hi.
Hello. Excuse me. Hello. Yes, I was wondering if spiders eat dust mites. I know dust mites are spiders in that.
Do spiders eat dust mites?
I don't know. There's got to be some spider that goes after them, but I don't know specifically.
But dust mites are not spiders, right?
No, they're a different order. Like, you know, we talked about the spiders are an order of arachnid, mm-hmm. a different order are harvestmen. A different order, the mites are belong to the order that ticks belong to. So they're kind of, ticks are kind of mite.
Okay. Mary, thank you for calling. Nate in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hey, the year before last, in the autumn, around this time, I all of a sudden dropped from a tree this bright orange spider. It looked like one of those kids' orange rings, you know, spider rings.
Yeah.
And I didn't think it was real at first, and then it started moving, and then I was like, wow, that's a spider. But I've never seen anything like that. Where is that from? And whatever, I mean.
Sure.
Was it like a very fat orange abdomen?
Yeah, it was big, like almost like with Black Widow sized.
Huh. That's
big. I don't think it would be that big. Do you? Or what am I saying?
I should ask you.
As a Black Widow.
Oh, these. If it's what I'm imagining, they're bigger than a Black Widow.
Oh,
they're,
okay.
At least the abdomen is wider than a Black Widow. With spiders, you need to use key to identify them, and it's mostly looking at the features of the genitalia. But I've seen one around here that so you do get a species like that. They're part of the family of oar weavers, like you know, garden spiders and others. It's probably something called the arabesque orb weaver, Neoscona arabesca, but I would need to be able to look at it under a scope to be sure.
But it's an orb weaver.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Nate, there you go. Thank you. Vicki in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I have a question about when I do yard work, if I'm rolling over a rock, and there's a spider under there. It appears to have like a white egg sac it's carrying. So I'm curious if this is the mating season, is that really an egg sac it's carrying, or what would that be?
Yeah, it could be. There's some spiders carry the egg sac in their mouth parts. Then the whole time, then the female is keeping the conditions right for the eggs. And she doesn't feed that whole time. Other species, they carry it with their the appendages that they use to spin web, so they carry it at the tip of the abdomen. Do you remember, was it at the hanging from the back of the spider or the front?
It appears to be on the back as they scurry away.
Uh-huh. That there's wolf spiders do that. I don't know. I'm not sure that is an example. It was a case of a wolf spider, but there's common species around here that are wolf spiders that you'd see them carry the egg sacs in their abdomen, at the back of their abdomen, the tip of their abdomen.
Yeah, probably. Could likely have been, Vicki. Thank you for calling. Vivian in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I try to peacefully coexist with all animal life, and so therefore I have spiders in my home, particularly a few of what I call kitchen spiders. They're very light colored, very fine, long, you know, they have longer legs, but their bodies are not really big. They're such a light color, sometimes you might think they're transparent. But one morning I got up and there was one in the t- tiniest amount of water in my dish strainer all shriveled up. And I'm kind of curious, so I thought, well, I wonder if it's really dead. So I took it out of there, held it in the palm of my hand for a while, and just, you know, put it close to my teeth to warm it up. Well, it woke up or revived. I thought, all right, now what do I do with it? I should feed it, right? So I had some canned cat food. I put it on the counter with the spider. No interest. Okay, what else have I got? I have steamed whitefish. Put that on the counter, and it did eat the whitefish. I have a video. And so I just went about my business, and the spider did too. But as I tell the story, other people are, oh, wow. And, you know, they're used to killing or running from spiders. But now I have a niece who took a spider out of her car and put it down, and my daughter is no longer squishing every spider she sees. So the story has helped. A little, so we can coexist.
Vivian, I think you got it right. Rafa, what do you think?
Yeah, we can definitely coexist, especially if that was sounded like the cellar spiders we were talking about.
Yeah,
those are absolutely no harm to humans. And I kind of, you know, they're kind of nice to look at, and the webs are kind of nice. Like, they add a little ambience to select corners of the house.
Yeah, that's a great story, Vivian. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you mentioned biting, and we've had a few emails relating to spiders. Do spiders actually bite and cause damage to us? They'll bite other insects maybe, but not so much us.
Yeah, they're all, except for one species that we know of, they're all predators, and they have their mouth parts. The biting mouth parts are interesting. If you think of insects, they have single piece mandibles, is one segment that moves. Spiders, each the fangs have two components, so they're like their fangs are elbowed, and then there's the piercing part, and they all inject some kind of venom to subdue their prey as they bite. But you know, if we what's most likely to happen is we inadvertently pick one up and we scare it, then it goes to be defensive or step on it or something like that. They're none of them are trying to come at us. They're not thinking of feeding on us or anything like that. But yeah, there's several where it would hurt. You'd notice it. And in some cases, there's some that are actually dangerous for humans. For example, black widows, that can get you into trouble. But like the way people get bitten by black widows is they're working at some construction site, or like there's debris in the garage, and you reach underneath to grab it and lift it, and then you squish the spider, and then it's purely accidental.
And black widows, we don't have black widows in Wisconsin, do we, or do we?
There's brown widows that we get in Wisconsin. No black widows, although I had a student that collected black widows in Oregon and worked with them here, but he graduated. So now we're back to no black widows in Wisconsin.
Okay. Marilyn in Verona, it's your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
My husband and I have restored the prairie around our house. We have several acres of prairie that's about 30 years old. And we used to have an abundance of spiders once the prairie became mature, especially what we called garden spiders, yellow and black spiders, and I love them. And I've noticed that since we've been burning, we have noticed a major decline in the numbers of spiders, and we really miss them. And so I'm wondering if there's a better time to burn the prairie based on the life cycle of the spiders. We typically would burn in the spring. What's the advice of the guest?
That I have no knowledge to offer advice. Because you've got to do the burning to to keep the prairie as prairie. If you, and I'm not sure that's necessarily that causing a decline. It could be like some different yearly patterns of weather. No, there I better say I don't know than start guessing.
Okay. All right, Marilyn. Thanks for calling. Martha in Hawkins, we'll go to you. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I have a story about black widows. Not black widows, brown recluse. I had a coworker, a lovely woman, who got bit by a spider, and medically and so on, they decided that it was a black, brown recluse. And she didn't go to the doctor right away because, you know, it's a spider bite, why would you? And it got necrotic around it, and so she went like 2 weeks after she was bit, and they gave her antibiotics, and she had this big sore on her leg. And as time went by, she ended up nearly dying several times in about 4 or 5 years, and, you know, went to the hospital with some kind of liver problem that almost killed her, and then she went and had, I don't know, something that left her pretty well debilitated. She couldn't think anymore. She could hardly walk. And this was all because of that spider bite. It was apparently, I think, it attacked her nervous system in the long run. You know, it goes through the system. Well, it kind of attacked all her systems.
Where did she live? Actually.
This was in Colorado.
Oh, Colorado.
And, yeah. And she was cleaning out brush around her apartment condo. And she eventually died about 5 years after she was bit.
Hmm.
Wow. That's hard.
Yeah, that's very bad. And as we, it's, as you were saying earlier, it's high. Rarely, I mean, they don't really want to bite you unless they think they're getting attacked in some fashion. So, and it's terrible to hear about that. But Martha, thank you for sharing the story. You can join in too, by the way. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Josh called, couldn't stay with us, wondering if daddy long legs have a poisonous bite.
They all do for their prey, but not, they wouldn't do us any harm. The daddy long legs cellular spiders. But they're all in the business of subduing prey. And not, you know, firstly, part of the bite of the prey is subdue it. They have different species have different sequences of wrapping them in silk, then biting, or biting first and wrapping them in silk. But then the way that they eat their prey is they inject digestive enzymes that liquefy the prey in the body of the insect. Then they suck it back. So that, you know, they're all doing really mean things to their insect prey. And in some cases, they can be dangerous to us, but not the daddy long legs.
You have studied...
Yeah, I'm much less comfortable with brown recluses in the house than I am with cellar spiders in the house.
You have studied spiders' brains, and we I think we've talked about it the last time you were on, but you've studied their memories and ability to count. Talk about maybe that research, and then does their memory come into play during the mate selection process?
Ah, I don't know. That's interesting. So a lot of the work we do is sort of, you know, like if you think about it in principle, a spider could be the classic example of how we used to think of animal behavior, like a robot system of pre-wired input-output responses, right? So how spiders build a web is long sequences of repeated motions, and then you get a wonderful web architecture. But it could be super simple repetitions of movements. And then once they're on the web, you know, like the web snares a fly, then sends vibration. The spider could be simply in the business of here's a stimulus, or go to that stimulus, eat the insect, right? But it turns out that they have a lot of, they have a lot of knowledge about their web, about the layout of the web, about the content of the web that they store in their memory. So give you a sense of one of the experiments we do. There's a species of orb weaver. You get relatives here, but this is a big one that you get in the southern US and in Central America. And the way they capture prey is they'll subdue it, wrap it in silk, then bring it to the center of the web, the hub, and hang it from a single silk thread, and then they start to eat it. So you can do experiments where you give them different numbers of prey, so they accumulate different numbers in the web, each of them hanging from a single thread. So they kind of have a larder of, you know, hanging hams hanging from their web. And then the experiment is give them different numbers of prey like that, and then steal them from them by just cutting that one silk. So at the end of the treatment, you have, you know, spiders that had captured 1, 2, 4, or whatever, and then went on to lose 1, 2, or 4. And there is no remnant in the web to say there used to be something here, right? There's no damage to the web. There's no hole. There's just the ham is gone. And then when you do that kind of experiment, you find this, they start searching, but not like they search for prey that fell on the web, which is sort of oriented to where the prey is. They're just walking around and around the web, tugging on it, getting feedback. They kind of even look angry. And they go on for you know, like if a spider loses prey in its web, and, you know, like 30 seconds you haven't found it, it's gone. They go on for almost an hour searching. So then that searching behavior is indicates they have a memory of, I had prey, it's gone, I'm looking for it. And they search longer for prey they prefer more. They search longer for higher counts of prey. So they have some sense for the number of prey items they had captured. So those experiments are a lot of fun to do because it's, you know, their spider behavior on the web is fun to watch. And watching them search angrily is even more fun.
So why do it? Why study it?
Part of the there's many different angles. My interest is they're trying to understand the behavioral capabilities and the cognitive capability, you know, the smarts, if you will, of animals with completely different brain designs than we have, right? There is nothing like a vertebrate brain. There's like 2 ganglia, very, very different, probably evolved from completely different ancestors. There's some debate about that, but likelihood is different, completely different origins to those brains that end up kind of being able to perform similar functions in the sense of make a mental model of the environment of the animal and the animal's position in that environment and pay attention to that mental model to navigate the world, right? To go about their business. So then if we can understand how those brains go about doing those things, they can better reflect on our understanding of how our brains do those things. That's the pure, like kind of, yeah, curiosity-driven knowledge of the world kind of thing, which down the line brings a lot of, you know, sets up more applied developments. But I tell myself is I'm in the business of creating problems for neuroscientists to figure out. Like, look, they can do this. Now you figure out how they do it.
Oh, man. Oh, and by the way, do you ever return that prey back to the mad spider who's running around trying to find his prey?
Yeah, well, not those individuals, but then afterwards they get a compensation treat.
Okay. Vince in Burlington. Your turn. Hi, Vince.
Yes, good morning. I have a quick story for you. About 10, 15 years ago, I went to a spider identification class at the Cedarburg Bog Biological Station of UW-Milwaukee. And the instructor basically said something like, no matter what your neighbors tell you, we don't have any poisonous spiders in Wisconsin. And a lady in the class had a little vial, and she handed it to him, and she said, what is this spider? And he says, that's a brown recluse. Where did you get it? She said, I found it in my kitchen in Menominee Falls. And he said, had you been traveling lately? She said, yeah, I just got back from vacation from New Orleans. So the spider had hitchhiked in her luggage, and she found it, I think, dead in her kitchen. So he was a little surprised, but the mystery was solved why it had been up here. So I don't know if climate change over in the future will have spiders migrate north, but that was an interesting little story that I was able to experience, if you will.
That's a great story, Vince. Thanks very much. It's probably why we occasionally will find one here in Wisconsin. But as Phil Pelletieri, the entomologist I had on before, if you were on, you've been on today, Rafa, he often said it's starting to feel like they moved the state of Missouri, got moved up to Wisconsin. there is some climate change going on.
Oh yeah, no question. And that's what you're seeing a lot of. A lot of modern day conservation efforts is not keeping the philosophy is trying to go to change from keeping things like they used to be to keeping things capable of receiving the new animals, the new organisms whose distributions are shifting northwards or southwards. That's an example of how you get bitten by a spider like that, right? You're just gathering your clothing. It was in the hotel and on the floor, and there's a spider there, right? So it pays to be careful.
Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I had two quick questions. I want to preface the start, though, that I've been personally bitten by a brown recluse here in Wisconsin on the top of my foot, and it did dissolve away the skin to about the size of a quarter. And it just dissolved all the skin away. But it went away without any medication or anything. I felt good. I've also been bitten by a brown recluse in Texas about 10 years ago and a scorpion. But beyond that, so I have been personally bit by brown recluse here in Wisconsin. So they are here, maybe rare, but they're here. But so my question actually is regarding what I thought was a banana spider, which I haven't seen in years. I used to love seeing those when I was a kid. But they're all over my yard, and it's not a banana spider, but it's about that same size. So it's got an abdomen about the size of a marble. And it's orangish yellow, but it doesn't have the black stripes on the abdomen, on the top of the abdomen, like a banana spider does. But it's about the same size and makes about the same size web. Now, maybe you could tell me what that spider is. I know it's a rough description. But in that same question there, I've been watching these spiders in my yard because I like to watch the spiders. And I've noticed they do not eat box elder bugs. None of the spiders in my yard will eat the box elder bugs or the stink bugs. And I was wondering if there's something specific that... why they don't like, even the big spiders, they don't like box elders or stink bugs, and I wish they did. But maybe you can tell me what the spider is and why they don't like certain bugs.
Sounds like an orb weaver in terms of the identification of some sort, Rafa.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably as far as deep as I can go without properly looking at it, but is it an orbicular web? Is it an orb web?
Yeah. Yeah, very round, about size of a marble on the abdomen, and you have orange and yellowish, kind of splotchy.
And the web is, what's the web look like?
The webs are pretty large. Like I said, I thought it was a banana spider because of the size of the web. It's probably got a 2-foot diameter web at least, and it's very much in your typical spider, more a triangle type looking web, the way it spread, at least the way in the flower gardens in my garden. But then it's not a very tight weave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that varies between species. If I had to guess, I'd probably say it's that arabesque orb weaver that another caller was talking about. But I would need to be able to look at it under a dissecting scope. For sure don't like stink bugs because what we smell in stink bugs is chemical defenses. that, you know, are an adaptation to protect them from some predators. So spiders have prey preferences. They'll go for, you know, if it's strongly chemically defended, they won't go for it. I would not have guessed box elder bugs had similar defenses, but they're closely related to stink bugs. So that could be like, you know, a preference to go for prey that are not chemically defended. A lot of the orb weavers around here, they're catching mosquitoes and midges, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking spiders today with Rafa Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and Juniper in Washburn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Juniper.
Hi. The earlier question about daddy long legs made me think of this, but I know that cellar spiders do have a mild venom used just to subdue prey, but there's a myth that harvestman spiders in particular have a very venomous bite and that they're just too small to bite humans. So I was wondering if that was any part of that is true, if they have any sort of a venomous bite or if they just have chelicerae that they use to eat without venom glands.
Yes, the second option. That so the harvestmen are the single body segment, right? Just one globular chubby body and then the head legs. They can prey, but they're often also eating, you know, like dead organisms they find, that kind of thing. So yeah, no venom.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rafa, I know you wanted to mention tree hoppers on the show today, and I saw a video on tree hoppers that was really cool in terms of their mating and so forth. And
oh, cool.
They're you're probably going to find more tree hoppers in the south or in southern climes, but we do have them here in Wisconsin. And they look pretty darn cool. Describe them.
So tree hoppers are a family of insects that they feed on the sap of plants. So they're sap-feeding insects. Their entire life is spent on their host plant. And the family is famous for having very weird shapes that, you know, the insect body plan is, you know, head, thorax, abdomen. And out of the thorax, they have weird projections that sometimes they look like they're little bits of plant debris. Sometimes they look like ants. But sometimes they're just doing their own thing. Completely, you know, super colorful, super, super interesting shapes. Some look like they have, you know, like satellite antennae with bulbs and spikes coming, bulbs coming out of the spikes. And they're a kind of insect that uses substrate-borne communication. So it's sound, but it's sound that they send along the stems of their host plants. So you have to tap into the movement of the substrate of the host plant to record it, to detect it. But those are so unlike what we normally think of as insect sounds. There's like crickets with their calls or like katydids, and they tend to be sort of something like ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. Kind of thing, right? Simple, repetitive, relatively broadband. Tree hoppers and other insects that use substrate-borne signals sound like it's more like bird song or whale song, super complex, a lot more vertebrate in structure. And they have male-female conversations. So a male that is searching for a mate will produce what's called an advertisement signal, some. It might sound, one species that we get here commonly sounds something like, ew. And then if a female is on the plant where the male is signaling, and if she likes him, she will respond back. And for the species we get around here, the response sounds something like, mmm. But there I start anthropomorphizing terribly, like she sounds like she's, how do you like this guy? Mm. Or, you know, he's kind of okay, but not that enthusiastic. It'll be like, Or she doesn't reply. And then, so their systems of communication are much more complex than we normally connect with insects. And you can sort of give them questionnaires, like in psychology experiments. So you can, with playback experiments, you can say, how do you like this guy? She responds. How do you like this guy? She doesn't respond. So you can describe their mate preferences in a lot of detail. And yeah, you like, if you have anywhere where you have a bit of backyard adjacent to a bit of forest, there is, if you have nannyberry, if you're anywhere near the plant nannyberry, odds are you have tree hoppers on it.
And that I was that video, the video title was Code of the Tree Hopper, and it did contain audio that they were able to, you know, to get. And it's really fascinating sounds, as you were describing. It was really, really, really cool. I wondered, you know, we're now 2 or 3 minutes left here. Spiders use something, they have a unique organ to produce silk for webs. Spinneret or something like that?
Yeah, their appendages at the tip of the abdomen, at the back end of the abdomen. And they have, you know, silk glands that open up to those appendages. And that's sort of the spinnerets are like the spigots out of where the silk comes out of. They have a whole array of different kinds of silk glands that make different kinds of silk. Some are for support and structure. Some have sticky glue on them. Different species produce different kinds of, have different ways of making the insects be snared by the silk. Some use glue droplets. Some use just a mesh of a wire that they get caught in. And they have adaptations in their legs to control and move the silk as it comes out of the spinnerets. Some are amazing. If you watch tarantulas as they build, they lay down silk on their tunnels. Their spinnerets are so long that they look like fingers, and they can control them individually like we control our fingers. It's amazing.
Oh, and the silk itself is actually, I think I read in that DNR publication, the DNR magazine for fall, that a spider's web silk is actually stronger than steel when you measure it by weight.
Yeah, it's pure protein, and it's stronger than steel, and yet more pliable, more bendable. So there's a lot of interest in the properties of silk and how you know, the biochemistry of how they achieve it, to then inform the design of products for human use. But yeah, when I was taking the spider class back in Costa Rica, my professor had collected, I made a little string. It was maybe quarter of an inch thick from silk he collected from the Nephila spiders, this big one that you get down south that have big green and black and yellow bodies. And he had a big old Isuzu Trooper. So he just tied the silk to the car, and we just pulled it with that thin a string of spider silk was strong enough to pull a big Isuzu Trooper.
Oh, my gosh. Well, on that note, Rafa, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Anytime. I'm happy to. Thank you very much.
Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Great to have him with us. Good show today, as always, I think. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our team that create our shows every day, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.